Society Library. I'm Carolyn Waters, the head librarian, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the lecture this evening. Before we start, I would like to just make the obligatory ask that if you have a cell phone, you please turn it off or turn it to silent if you might. And if you'll permit me, I'd actually like to appropriate Abigail Adams' admonishment to her husband to remember the ladies. And ask you to remember the New York Society Library during our annual appeal. It's a little crass, I understand. But your contributions really do make a difference, and they allow us to put on great programs like what you're going to see tonight. And actually, a little side note, which may be pertinent, Abigail's husband, John Adams, our second president, was actually a member of the New York Society Library. So it's a nice little fact there. Also, I should mention that, you know, we do date from 1754, and there were not a lot of institutions at the time that did admit women. And we were one of the very few that have had women members and women subscribers from our earliest days. So I think also sort of pertinent to this audience as well. So on November 6, 1917, just about a century ago, women won the right to vote in New York State. It was not until a few years later, in 1920, the 19th Amendment gave that same right to women across the country. Both these victories were difficult and hard won, and followed decades of struggle, raising public awareness, publishing pamphlets, protesting, lobbying elected officials, and using all the tools available to active women and their male supporters. In this anniversary year, we're very fortunate to be able to bring together two scholars of the suffrage movement. They have framed their talk tonight around 10 things you're likely not to know about the ladies, and also about the gents, too. Angela P. Dodson is the author of Remember the Ladies, Celebrating Those Who Fought for Freedom at the Ballot Box. She is an independent editor, writer, and consultant who founded the editorial services company Editors on Call in 2012. Angela is a former senior editor and former style editor for the New York Times and the former executive editor of Black Issues Book Review. Remember the Ladies highlights women's impact on United States politics and government, drawing on historic research, biographies of leaders, and such original sources as photos, line art, charts, graphs, documents, posters, ads, and buttons. Important for today's discussion, Remember the Ladies does not extract women's suffrage from the inseparable concurrent historic endeavors for emancipation, immigration, and temperance. Its robust research documents the intersectionality of women's struggle for the vote in its true context with other progressive efforts. Brooke Kroger's new book is The Suffragettes, How Women Used Men to Get the Vote. She's a journalist, author, and a journalism professor at NYU, where she directs graduate students in global and joint program studies. Her previous books include Passing, When People Can't Be Who They Are, Fanny, The Talent for Success of writer Fanny Hurst, and Nellie Bly, Daredevil, Reporter, Feminist. Kirkus Reviews says of The Suffragettes, among the pleasures of Kroger's carefully developed storyline is the view of how important political figures such as Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson came around to accepting the idea that women deserved the vote. It is a vigorous, readable revisitation of the events of a century and more ago, but with plenty of subtle lessons in the book for modern-day civil rights activists, too. So please join me in welcoming Angela P. Dodson and Brooke Kroger.
More generous and favorable to them than your ancestors. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. I'm not counting that as one of my 10 checks. And these are more paragraphs than quick facts. The first European woman to come to the North American mainland was Eleanor White Dare. In 1587, not long after arriving at Roanoke Island, North Carolina, she gave birth to a daughter, Virginia Dare. But the entire colony disappeared, and she was never heard of again. The book goes on to talk about what happened to the women at Jamestown and what happened to the women at Plymouth Rock. A second set of facts around the Second Continental Congress. It did not really make any laws and deferred to the states the question of who would vote. New Jersey was the only state to give women the vote at the outset in the state constitution adopted in 1776. All adult residents, including women who owned a specified amount of property, could vote. That right ended in 1807 when the legislature suddenly discovered a need to reinterpret the Constitution and it passed a law stripping women and black men of the vote. When the U.S. Constitution was written in 1787, it did not deal with the woman suffrage question either. Next, few American women were educated and very few schools served them in the early history of the United States. Oberlin admitted women in 1837, and Mount Holyoke was started the same year. Few women had any income of their own. Women had no right to own property, to divorce, and to control custody of their own children. Married women had no legal identity separate from their husbands. Women were strongly discouraged from public speaking. A free black woman, Maria Miller Stewart, emerged as the first American woman to address audiences of both men and women, and those were known as promiscuous audiences. And she spoke from the years 1831 to 1833 about things like abolition and the education of children. Quaker women, however, were allowed to speak in their churches, and they were among the first leaders of the women's movement for that reason. Most of the early leaders of the women's movement were radical abolitionists. They were among those radical abolitionists in the country. Several were active participants in the Underground Railroad, and some of their homes, including Jane Hunt's and Marianne McClintock's, are listed as part of the National Park Service's Underground Railroad network. Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and others wrote about their participation on the Underground Railroad. They wrote about encounters where they had actually assisted someone or seen one of their neighbors or relative assist somebody. And that was very rare for people to do that. Lucretia Mott was a Philadelphia Quaker preacher, considered the first interracial anti-slavery meetings to be the beginning of the women's movement. Not Seneca Falls. The women's suffrage movement had support from some prominent men early on. You'll hear the later stages later, but Frederick Douglass, Henry Ward Beecher, Aaron Augustus Sargent, who actually introduced the first federal women's suffrage amendment. During the Civil War, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony led a movement to help secure passage of the 13th Amendment to assure that those freed from slavery would remain free after the war. They established the Women's National Royal League and obtained 400,000 signatures to petition Congress. Other women who worked in the Civil War, including people like Carol Tubman, who was a spy, expected that they would be rewarded, perhaps, with a vote after the war. That did not happen. One of the earliest breakthroughs in the suffrage movement came in 1869 when the Wyoming Territory gave women the right to vote, and the Utah Territory followed the next year, 1870. I see Claymore shaking, nodding her head. And there's a whole chapter about Wyoming. Many of the men and women involved in the women's movement got their start in the temperance movement, and many were active simultaneously in both. The temperance movement was an organized effort, of course, to encourage abstinence and discourage strong drink. It became a women's issue because having a drunk husband, when you had no rights to protect yourself, your own your property, earn a living, or protect your children and get them away from the old drunk was a dangerous thing. Finally, black women and men were participants in the women's suffrage movement from its earliest awakenings, especially in the period leading up to the Civil War and later years leading to victory. These outspoken African Americans are documented throughout this book and integrated into the story with texts and photographs. They include such women as Sojourner Truth, who freed herself from slavery in upstate New York before the state abolished slavery and became a frequent speaker on the women's circuit. However, she may never have uttered the most famous speech that we have all memorized and seen recited for years. And we can talk more about that later.
That's pretty good. Hi, I'm Brooke Croker, as you've already heard. I want to say just a word about this place where all five of my books have had some period of time spent, especially my earliest one. The collection of magazines that you can feel and touch going back to very early times is exceptional, and it's just really a treasure, and I wanted to acknowledge that. I also want to acknowledge my sister-in-law, who's here from Italy and gave up Norma at the Met to be here. So, Angela, we have to really put it on. Anyway, so here are my 10. This was Angela's conception. I thought it was great, so I said, yeah, let's do it. Men were deeply involved, as Angela's told you, from a very early point, but also right to the end in ways that were far more significant that we know, because the men did not tout what they did. They were consummate allies in sort of the contemporary sense of that word. It's not in their obituaries, it's rarely in their memoirs, certainly not that they had an organized movement. They founded, started, and ran themselves, including all the scout work. It's a fact. They were not just celebrity endorsers, they did the hard work of every kind. They formed an organization that grew into a force of thousands across 35 states and most of the developed world. Who were these members in this last critical decade of a 70-year-long slog? They were very important figures of all the avenues of thought and power in this city and in this state. Business, finance, the courts, the clergy, the writers, the editors. I mean, it was an extraordinary group who were Democrats, Republicans, independents, socialists. They came together because they were progressives and believed in the importance of an important social cause. Most of them, it's true, brought to this by wives, lovers, sisters, and mothers. I mean, that's a fact. And their activism excited this very, very important response that was not talked about much after it happened. They helped finance the effort through direct support, their pocketbooks, and also through underwriting the activism of their wives, who they let go free to do all this work, not go free, but released from other duties to be as active as they were. And they made sacrifices, certainly, in this way. I'm going to point to the sacrifice of Dudley Field Malone, which was quite exceptional. He was a New York attorney who was very involved in Wilson's election, had really helped sway the state of California and had that credit. And in gift, he was made the collector of the Port of New York, which was one of the top patronage positions, which he resigned from because Wilson would not come around on suffrage. And I'm not going to tell you the rest of that story, but it's a number two. Three successive presidents, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and Woodrow Wilson, all employed the artful dodge not to sign up for a federal suffrage amendment. They used the state's rights argument, which you hear a lot for other reasons. You know, this is a matter for the state. They were very good at that. Another argument, certainly, that Taft used and Roosevelt, when all the women will want it, they will get it. Of course, understanding that many women opposed the idea. That was a pretty interesting one. Then, of course, Theodore Roosevelt runs again for president against Wilson as the Bull Moose Party candidate. He, realizing, I think, that Wilson is not going to get off this ledge, commits for women's suffrage, much to the disdain of the suffrage movement, because everyone had seen how he had behaved as president, and no one was particularly excited about this. except Jane Addams herself. The convention was in Chicago, and she indeed becomes the seconder of his nomination. As I said, the suffrage movement wasn't so enthusiastic about that. He eventually came around, Wilson, not till 1917, just around the time the New York vote was happening. He certainly endorsed the New York vote. He had voted himself in New Jersey, though in 1915 when that referendum failed. But in 17, he did do a statement saying, you know, people should come forward. And a lot changed. You know, some would say because of Alice Paul and her forces on the White House lawn. I personally think it was much more, Angela and I could talk about this, a case of the women's war effort, what had happened during the war, the sacrifices women had made, both personally and the war work they had done, which was so exceptional. Wilson's biggest problem in coming forward was the Southern senators, who were terrified of the increase in the black vote that would happen by women getting the vote in the South. And somehow I think the momentum of this war effort made him get off the fence. And at the same time, several more states, including New York, had passed the vote. So the force in Congress was larger of states that were willing to support it. So all those things coalesced and happened about the same time. But the war was key. Three, W.B. Du Bois was not a member of the Men's League, but he was certainly a fellow traveler. Oswald Garrison Ballard, John Dewey, who were founders of the Men's League, were of course his colleagues at the NAACP. He had well-earned misgivings about the women's suffrage movement, we have to say that. White women were not fantastic to black men. He was very aware of that and spoke about it in his critical essays. There had been terrible discriminatory behavior towards African-American women within the movement. You know, not overt, but there. In many ways, there were certain resolutions that tried to get passed at the National Convention, and there was no support for it because people were afraid of offending the South. This is always an issue. But he did give full-throated support to the movement for two very critical reasons, and they were unassailable, they were inarguable. One was that a people who had been disenfranchised could not stand for the disenfranchisement of another people. That was unthinkable, it's clear. And secondly, that the black vote would increase. I mean, these were two very, very good reasons for the support. And he would say this over and over again. There are at least 10 opinion columns and two full issue seminars with many, many speakers, both African American and white, promoting the whole suffrage cause at critical junctures, both in 1915 when New York tried to vote and again in 1917. So totally important. Four, that in a 70-year campaign, the most inventive, exciting, attention-getting, brilliant, spectacular, and strategically smart elements were all New York born, B-O-R-N, and New York born, B-O-R-N-E. It all came here. This was the most important and the most magnificent of all the state campaigns. The parades, these incredible gimmicks they came up to try to get men on board. You can imagine how interested the women were in baseball, and yet there they are at the stadium with fans saying, "I am a suffrage fan," you know, just things like that. They did a telesuff phone call campaign where they called every man in the state they could get their hands on or telephone wire on and promoted the cause. They had special campaigns for the plumbers and for the street cleaners and for, you know, just anyone you could think of. It was pretty fantastic. This was also the period in that last decade where they cultivated both the socially prominent New Yorkers and the powerful, influential men. Both happened at the same time. And it was extremely important to the movement's cause in bringing it to popular understanding. So what had been for 60 years really dowdy suddenly became dazzling. I mean, it really was this transformation in style that brought very good publicity and news coverage. And of course, all these editors and publishers who belong to the Men's League are putting this stuff in the paper. I mean, that's happening at the same time, so this can't really be ignored. The access to avenues of power came in those last 10 years in a very, very profound way. And also, so many of the men's leaders were in Wilson's closest circles. They had access. I mean, the women could get in to go have a little meeting, but these are his friends. So, you know, just a very, very different situation. Seven, style mattered, as I was just saying. So you saw this two ways, both in these elegant society dames who came to the fore. Each of them got, not all of them, but certainly Alva Belmont and Catherine Duer McKay got their own organization so they could be the heads of them. That seemed very important. Much like the men's league, that you created a separate bastion that didn't seem to be coming from NASA, the National American Women's Suffrage Association, but rather were a collaborating organization, and yet they were all very, very intertwined. But, you know, gave the impression of separate groups that were working towards this cause, and often of like-minded or like people. So that was also part of that. So there was the majesty of these parades that happened year after year from 1910 through 1917. And of course, in the early years, there were the pageantry, the Grecian flowing costumes, the marching bands, the color coordination in green, purple, and white, or yellow and white, or gold and white, and just astounding spectacles down Fifth Avenue. And then in the war years, somber, quiet, and appropriate to the times. So there was a lot of sense of importance of form and color, and a lot of that brought the disinterested, the disengaged, and, you know, the dubious to have attention for this wonderful movement. Eight, there's a bronze plaque in Albany that was struck in early 1930s, and it's on the south wall in the hall of the Capitol building, and it lists in bronze all the great women of the New York campaign, going back to, it goes back a little further, I think, than Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. I have to check that. But fully 20% of the names on that plaque come from this last decade. And of those 20%, because I went through and checked them all, about that 20% are on the 1917 social register, which is kind of interesting to say how important they were to the movement. It leaves off Alva Belmont and Catherine Duer McKay, who were both very important, but everyone was mad at them, so you can see why they didn't get on. But it does include Katrina Eli Tiffany, Vira Borman Whitehouse, Alice Dewar Miller, Narcissa Cox Vanderlip, and Harriet Burton Laidlaw, who were all society figures, but hard, hard workers in this campaign. So that's, you know, pretty interesting. Number nine, that same plaque to the great women of New York includes one man's name, James Lees Laidlaw, who was the national president of the Men's League. He himself was an important social figure, a financier, head of a small, not so small, investment bank. He could trace his lineage back to colonial days through 50 different lines. And he was just knee-deep in this campaign, largely because of the inspiration of his wife. There's no doubt about that, Harriet Burton Laidlaw. Why is he on that plaque? He deserves to be, but I'm sure it happened because he dies the year before the plaque is struck. And by that point, of course, it's the 1930s, and NASA has evolved into the League of Women Voters, which we all know today, and Harriet Laidlaw was the president of the New York League, so that probably accounts for that, but it was a good enough reason. And then 10, I want to share with you the mission statement of the League. There are copies of this that are out on the table. It's a letterpress version done by Thornwell Press that's pretty beautiful, but I'd like to read it to you. It's attributed to Laidlaw, and I'd like to think that he actually did write it. There are many men who inwardly feel the justice of equal suffrage, but who are not ready to acknowledge it publicly unless they're backed by numbers. There are other men who are not even ready to give the subject consideration until they see that that a large number of men are willing to be counted in favor of it. The man who is so prejudiced that he will not consider it at all will pass away with this generation, if not sooner. The usefulness of the men's leagues politically to women constitutes one of the unanswerable arguments for women's suffrage. And legislators are mainly responsible to voters, and voters only. In the majority of states in this country, earnest, determined women are besieging the legislatures, endeavoring to bring about the submission of a women's suffrage amendment to the people. How long and burdensome is this effort on the part of non-voters, everyone knows. If a well-organized minority of men demand equal suffrage legislation from the legislatures, they will get it. So think, if a well-organized minority of men demand equal pay for equal work, demand an end to violence against women, demand an end to making women beasts of burden in a large part of this world, they will get it. After that, it is only a question of propaganda, and the men's leagues come in again on the first proposition of moral support.
Should we just go right to the group?
Oh, I thought we were going to ask each other a question.
We can.
I'll just do one. Where did you get the idea to do this and how? What turned you on to do it?
To do it? I'm a contrarian. As I always say, I order a china pattern or a crystal pattern, they discontinue it immediately. This is just sort of how I see the world. And I'm always looking for a subject that hasn't been done. I don't think I'm good enough to redo somebody else's work, so I always want to break ground. And I've done that with all my books. They're subjects of obscure interest, but they're my interest, so that's just how it is. And I knew the suffrage anniversaries were coming up. This must be 4 or 5 years ago. And it's just about the time I need to do this kind of research. And I started, what can I do that hadn't been done that would be fresh, that would put a new, like it would take the kaleidoscope and turn it a degree or two so a new picture emerged. And then I asked myself, how could they possibly have done this without the men? The men were the voters, the men controlled the legislatures, the men controlled Congress. They would not have had access. How could they have possibly done it? They must have had male support. So a simple Google search would show you that indeed there's the Men's League for Women's Suffrage. So I get all excited. And I think, they're probably going to be celebrity endorsers. They signed a few letters, like Fannie Hurst used to do, and not so meaningful. They've already been down that route. And so I went further and further, and then if you start going through the daily newspapers every day for 10 years, now indexing helps, the way that it didn't used to, where you can actually do it digitally instead of scrolling microphone and hoping to find something. It turns out that they were speakers, orators, writers, they're in the streets campaigning. When the 1915 campaign is lost, the press goes to the Herald Tribune, the Herald building, to talk to the men who've been there counting the votes and calculating. The night before that, when the women were so tired in 1917, the men went and took their place on the streets. I mean, they engaged. And then, of course, the editors and writers like Du Bois and others who really put out in ways that the women certainly expressed gratitude for in the moment, but the people have kind of stopped talking about because this is a women's story. I think it's only a time now, and when I first tried to send this proposal around, the response was not great. People would say, who cares what the men did? It was that kind of an answer. Oh, I'd love to work with you, but never about this. And that happened more than a few times, believe me. And I just stuck with it because I thought, this really is a great topic. And now you start to see Ashton Kutcher, Andy Murray, men coming forward for women's rights. So that's my story. Yes?
I'm wondering though, you know, now there was an unfolding. So I think it's really important to acknowledge the fact that it was the men and these powerful men that you mentioned, Horace Greeley, the women who were dedicated abolitionists, that if they would put suffrage on the back burner and work for abolition, then when abolition came, then the men would support women's suffrage. The men did not do that.
That's about
they betrayed them, and they said, now it's really too difficult to do women's suffrage. We're going to give black men.
Correct.
That is actually a cataclysmic problem, for the simple reason that split the movement between Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucy Stone. And yes, of course, Lucy Stone stayed with these powerful men, but I don't think those men were very admirable as far as their role in women's suffrage.
Well, those are not my guys.
And in 1919, it was by one vote that wasn't even certain. So I don't doubt that men were supportive. I really, in my research, have found absolutely no evidence of the fact that they were so significant that they actually had to buoy up these poor, exhausted women.
Well, no one has suggested that.
Push them over because they didn't. They blocked them at every turn. And what is admirable about the suffragists is that in 60 years, they didn't give up.
That's
they
true.
They admit defeat. And Henry Ward Beecher, who was also very prominent, single-handedly destroyed an absolutely incredible woman, Victoria Woodhull.
Correct.
Single-handedly.
Correct.
So those, I think, if we're going to say they did nice things, I don't doubt they did. But as far as being the catalysts of this movement,
anyone has suggested that.
It's a woman's role, and they did it. And they did it when they did not have the power base. They did anything they didn't have the power base. Absolutely.
I dealt with that a great deal in my book, starting from the beginning. And there are two sides to the story, though, too. In many ways, they were instrumental. From the beginning, Frederick Douglass was the only man of color to be at the Central Falls Convention, and he is the only person in the convention who spoke up for the plank to ask for the vote. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton,
correct,
offered it, and it passed. But it's the only resolution that did not pass unanimously. Frederick Douglass stayed in the movement even beyond the split over the 14th and 15th Amendments. He never hardly missed the convention. He was a close friend of Susan B. Anthony and her family. He stayed close to Elizabeth Cady Stanton, even though they had their differences.
Sure.
Many, many times. And on the day he died in 1895, he was at a woman's convention all day, and came home to describe it to his wife, and he died while describing the meeting to her. He's just one person. There were also very many men, abolitionists, in the particular places like Philadelphia, black abolitionists and white abolitionists, who worked for the movement. During the 1850s, men came to every convention. Sometimes they spoke, sometimes they sent letters of support. Very well-established men. And the other thing to consider is that when the 14th and 15th Amendment was offered, to black people, this was a crisis. And this was a real issue that they could probably not get the 14th and 15th Amendments through Congress at the same time they got women's suffrage through Congress. So, you know, the fact that women were told to take a back seat then was a problem. But some men still worked for the women's group. Some men went into the association that Cady Stanton and Anthony formed. There were always men active in that group, and not just Henry Ward Beecher. So you have to remember that women could not have done anything. They could have never offered the amendment to even consider it if a man hadn't done it. They couldn't vote on the resolutions when the states were getting the votes because they didn't already have the vote.
Except in states where they did have the vote.
Right, except
that's all
right.
Yeah.
But before Wyoming or before, you know, those places, there was no woman in the country who could vote on all questions. There were spotty things where women could vote for the school board in this state or that state, or they could vote in state elections, or they could do something or other, but not a full vote.
I don't think anyone disputes that this was a women's movement and a women's victory. There's no suggestion of that at all. It's just interesting to know the way in which men over these decades did participate, in addition to the opposition that you so correctly stated, but there were other men who really did help in very significant ways. It's a fact.
And the other thing is, if the movement had not split, if they'd all just stayed and worked together, suffrage probably would have come much earlier as well. Because what they did was they divided their efforts.
Sure.
They were putting out
sure.
newspapers. They were running two organizations.
People were
two conventions.
Everything.
Right. And they're barely speaking for years and years and years until they got back together.
Fact.
I would like to make a comment, and if you can use your scholarly wisdom to correct, embellish, because it was a very strong statement, and I don't totally get that. Perhaps I just get elephant in the room. Black men were getting lynched.
Yes.
They were getting killed. And in conversation that I'm familiar with or read about between Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass, he reminded her of the conditions that black men were exposed to.
And Du Bois did the same.
I believe he said that when you are being dragged out of your home and killed, then let's have a conversation in terms of the sequencing of that present. I'm also aware that he came to regret that he should have been more proactive in the beginning about women's rights to vote. But my understanding, I'll turn it back over to you, that it wasn't so black and white. There was the point that you're making, I feel, as I've come to, because you have to be viewed in the context of the time in terms of what black men were actually going through and why they wanted the right to vote because of things that they felt were injustices and the very real killings that they were experiencing vis-a-vis their women. So I just wanted to put that out there.
It's not the women, Kate Stanton, the woman I'm researching, absolutely. They were, that's why they worked for abolition. They were completely with it. What they were angry about, and I feel as a doctor, was that these very prominent men that we are admiring said to the women, we will support suffrage for women. They didn't say at the beginning, vote for, work for abolition, and then we'll support a suffrage amendment for men. Had they said that, that would have been one thing, but they didn't. They said the exact opposite. That's why the women got upset. Because, and it had nothing to do with them not understanding the dilemma of the black men. They certainly did. But when they're promised one thing and the men turn against it and basically say, oh, forget it, I mean, I would be angry too.
Elizabeth Cage Stanton was often angry, but I want to go back over to what he said. This conversation, there was this conversation between Anthony and Douglass at a meeting in the 1860s, shortly after the Civil War. And he said exactly what you said, when your people are being dragged out. And Anthony says, well, isn't that true of black women too? And he said, yes, but because they're black, not because they are women. The other debatable point is that Elizabeth Cady Stanton is called out during one of these meetings because she is writing things that are very anti-black. She's called out by a white man on this at several meetings. And that's why she really walked out of that meeting and started her own organization. And, you know, she was not necessarily the most active abolitionist as the other women were. Her husband was an abolitionist. But there's not as much evidence that she was really, really serious about it. So.
Also, just to make sure the distinction is clear, because I didn't really state it, the men that I'm talking about are active from 1909 to 1919. So it's a much later group of men. It's a progressive era men, very, very different.
Yes.
I feel like I jumped into the middle of an advanced level seminar. Formally educated, but she had her father's own life, and she had
she was, you know, talked to me by someone in the family or whatever. They say she was informal too. So most of the women we know about, well, a lot of these women were not really upper crust that were active in the movement early, but they had been, they were certainly high up on the chain for their era. Many of them, as I say, were teachers first. Susan B. Anthony was a teacher first. Carrie Chapman Catt was a teacher first. I forget who else, but and the other ones were, you know, journalists or writers, or they became journalists in order to facilitate
clergy.
Clergy people. Some of them were doctors, some of the first women doctors in the country, the first women educators. And then until women got college degrees, which would have been really late in the 1800s, for the most part, they couldn't speak out. They didn't have anything to speak out about. They, you know, had no knowledge of politics or whatever. So. And there were huge taboos against educating women. And very few women had the means to get education.
We know what the arguments were, pro and con. We have a pretty good sense of that. The home,
yeah.
We need you in the home. Who will take care of the home? The home that matters, the family matters. You're not educated to know about politics. How can you possibly have anything to say about civic affairs? You haven't been inculcated with that knowledge. You know, those were the common arguments, both coming from men and women, that were the anti-arguments.
My grandmother was born in Brooklyn in 1890, an American Jewish woman. And she would tell me stories when I was a little girl, and I'd like to know if any of them are true. But she was active in the women's suffrage movement. But she said that the Jewish women in New York had separate groups and were not accepted with the rest of the suffragette movement in New York. They were more educated than a lot of the other women in America.
So that's not entirely true, because Maude Nathan was very active. She was one of the top organizers of suffrage. That isn't quite true. And for African-American women, the problems were often social and cultural. Like John Dewey organized a meeting inviting, he lived on Willing, you know, right on the edge of Central Park at 110th, and organized it in his home with his wife, who was also an active suffragist. John Dewey was a founder of this men's league. And no one could get in the door. The building threw a fit that black people were going to enter. I mean, these were the kinds of things that were involved. I kept thinking, why wasn't Du Bois a member of the League, since he was so connected to everyone? First of all, he didn't like Villard so much. They both had written books about John Brown. There was, you know, a lot of issues there. But he couldn't have probably gotten into the clubs. I mean, you're just sort of like, there were so many social and cultural barriers that were really hard. Alva Belmont did a lot of organizing in Harlem and really encouraged African-American women to join her political equality league. So that, you know, she did make that effort and got props for it, at least in the socialist newspapers.
Right, there were times that black women were discouraged from forming their own chapters or from going to conventions or from participating in the parades.
Well, they were, from what I read, they were relegated to the back of the group, not integrated with the white groups.
So no wonder they were mad. I mean, of course.
I was just going to ask you if you ever came across in your research a man named George Middleton, a very popular playwright.
The playwright, he's a big figure in my book.
Well, that was I did a little program not long ago about suffragists from the stage. And so I chose Paula LaFollette, Izetta Jewell, that nobody knew anything about, and Mary Shaw. And it went very well. I think a lot of people don't realize, because I belong to a professional theater women's organization.
Wonderful.
I'm trying to do suffrage programs up to 2020.
Good for you.
50-50 in 2020. Mm-hmm. And so the first was, well, let's use some actresses. If you look at the list on the internet, which is not complete, I don't believe, you will find names you're missing. Now, for instance, the LaFollette family was one of the most progressive families. Fighting Bob LaFollette, his wife, his children, and Paula. They grew up in a political environment in Wisconsin. And as a progressive senator, he was very instrumental in Congress trying to get suffrage done. How could he not with all those women around him?
So Middleton was very active in the league. He wrote several plays. They didn't get a lot of, like a one-night stand on Broadway, I think. But a lot of them followed Star In, and they were performed around the state in small venues.
I'm sure you came across the piece that he writes about being in the first parade down Fifth Avenue when there were 87 men.
So it's a really, you know, it's interesting you bring that up. That parade where 89 men marched and others joined them. So you have these pro-union workers where, you know, Alva Belmont and Catherine Dormaquet were not going to go march in any parade, and that was not happening. But the men were willing. So in their top hats and their fedoras and their bowlers, a mix, they formed this crew, and they are pelted, catcalled, brickbatted, their masculinity is assaulted, and they kind of love it. And in any memoir, it comes up in almost every memoir. It's the only mention they make of any association with suffrage. They never mention the League. Villard, whose idea it was, never mentions it. He only talks about that bloody parade and, you know, going past the Union Club and all their friends looking down on them, just thinking they've lost their minds. And, you know, Villard says it was so galvanizing. It was just, we were ready to do it again tomorrow. It was that kind of response.
And then the postscript to that is the next parade, there were 1,000 men, and George did not have
quite,
as much
but close. Close. And then more and more every year. And they marched in Washington. They did this. Some went on horseback with Rosalie Jones and her crew and did all those things. Yeah. It's pretty great. Any other questions?
What was the women's suffrage movement correlate with women's education, particularly hot women's higher education?
Well, I mentioned that until women could get an education, it was a problem. The first schools that were colleges that would have admitted women were in 1837. Ron Holyoke was not quite a college when he was first formed. It was female seminary or something. But it's still considered the first college. And then there's a couple more that come along after that, academies and such. So that by the time you get to 1900 and Alice Paul and the 1913 parade, women are highly educated.
They're marching in caps and gowns.
Right.
And I think showing it off.
Exactly. Alice Paul has something like 6 college degrees. A couple of them from my alma mater, one of them, American U. So a lot of women who are active between 1900 and 1920 have 2 and 3 college degrees.
The fact that women were getting higher education, that women who had advanced education participate actively in women's suffrage?
Yes, they did.
Very,
very, very active. Lucy Stone had a couple of sisters-in-law who were doctors, and they were not full participants like she was, but a lot of times these women who had more education were leaders of the conventions and meetings.
Dr. Shaw?
Yeah, Dr. Shaw was both a medical doctor and a minister. So we have women like that coming along. Carrie Chapman Catt had a college education, and her mother had been educated. So education really kind of turns the whole movement and fuels the movement, as far as I'm concerned.
The woman I researched, Woman Brown, was the first woman ordained to the ministry. The woman I was researching, Olympia Brown, was the first woman ordained to the ministry, and she graduated from St. Lawrence in 1861, and she actually was very active in encouraging schools to, and professional schools especially, to be open to women, because until women could be educated for the professions, they couldn't achieve a tremendous amount of independence financially or for profession. So in 1850, Antioch College was actually the first, Oberlin was the first college to be co-ed. Lucy Stone went there, but Oberlin would not let her give the valedictory speech because she was a woman. Mm-hmm. So the woman I'm researching, Olympia Brown, refused to go to Oberlin and went to Antioch. But in her famous speech, she tells women that they have to come up to the mark, that the opportunities have to be there, but women have to be not only co-ed, but there were graduate schools that were open to them.
Does that relate to the fact that there was such a lack of men after the Civil War that areas that women, that men were lacking in certain areas, and therefore women needed, and women were single, and there were no men for them to marry, and therefore there were positions available for them in the economy, as in education and librarians, the things that we associate later with being female professions, but weren't necessarily so historically.
Right, and they were, the suffragists that were very prominent. One was a lawyer, two were lawyers, there were doctors, there were quite a few teachers, and after Olympia Brown, there were a few ministers, but there was a big problem with ministers because the idea of a woman speaking in public was considered so radical.
Any other questions? Maybe on a different topic? Yes?
Yeah, just this. There was supposed to be a statue in Central Park on the mall.
They're working on it.
Good, I hate money.
They're working on it. There's an online site where you can donate.
Okay.
It's supposed to be the website. They're still working on it.
Good. And what's the website?
It's called, if you look up Susan B. Anthony statue, it'll come right up.
Is it just Susan B. Anthony?
No, it's she and Elizabeth King Stanton. Colleen Jenkins, who's her great-great-granddaughter, is very, it was Harriet Stanton Blanche's great-granddaughter, is highly involved. And is lovely. It's really a terrific woman.
Those two.
The two. That's the idea. That there'll be a two. Because, you know, it takes two women if you want to try to get a statue. You know, it's sort of like, one is not good enough. There was just a news item about the appropriation for the World War I centennial is $3 million, and for the women's centennial is $1 million. It sort of tells you everything. I mean, it just tells you everything.
In Boston, there we actually do have a women's statue, and it's Lucy Stone, the great suffragist, Abigail Adams, and Phyllis Wheatley, the African-American poet.
So they need three there. Okay.
And during the election when Hillary Clinton, we had hoped for the win, there were flowers all over the statues, and many women put their I voted stickers all over Lucy Stone, Abigail Adams, and Phyllis Wheatley.
I want to make one note about Lucy Stone is that she grew up on a farm, and she had to raise her money herself to go to Oberlin. She spent something like 6 years saving enough money to enter, so she was pretty old by the time she got to
Oberlin. I was wondering if there were any men of the younger generation, these women had sons. Did the sons participate, were the father mothers?
Totally. We have some of the most important elements of the men's league are the Ivies, and of course they were all male at the time. Harvard, Princeton, Yale, all those delegations marched in the parades. Every campus, almost all of the Ivy campuses and others, of course, had men's league chapters. So that was definitely part of this last decade. I can't tell you about earlier. I haven't really studied this last decade.
Now we're in Saudi Arabia, finally women can drive.
Next year.
The younger men, it's somehow I think that women raise more aware children, then this is also something that can change.
I don't think we can document that, but it's a great idea.
Mitchell, wasn't there a delegation of boys too?
Well, there was Rabbi Stephen Wise, who was one of the founders of the league. His 10-year-old son leads a boys' brigade in the, I think it's the 1912 parade. So that actually didn't happen. I think that'd be a good chapter for your book.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be a way to get children into it. I think we're at time. Less than one more question.
Sure. It strikes me how there are so many echoes of what you're talking about from the past that are still going on today in terms of racial and gender injustice. And I would like to ask each of you if you could just speak to what you wrote about and how it relates to what's going on in today's political climate.
What a great question. Why don't you start?
Well, certainly, you know, this last election shows us that there's this huge divide. One, that 53% of white women voted against Hillary Clinton. 96% of black women voted for Hillary Clinton.
So don't blame us. But a lot
of the same issues were in the women's movement in the 70s, the divide between black women and white women. And, you know, my book didn't start out to be a black book. It's not a black book. It's a book about the movement and their attributes of black women. And because I'm black, some things interested me more than others, or that people had not necessarily emphasized. But, you know, in terms of racial climate, we still have a lot of the same issues, and we still, and black women still have some of the same problems that they feel white women don't take their problems seriously. White women may feel that we don't take theirs seriously. So, you know, we're going to see the same issues, and it's just exacerbated by this last election cycle and the kinds of rhetoric that's tossed around, you know, people grabbing people's body parts and stuff. And, you know, from that aspect, I think Michelle Obama said something today about women who didn't vote for Hillary were voting against their own voice. So I just happened to catch that on my way here. I didn't see the whole speech yet.
Oh, I know. You were going to say that Sojourner Truth did not write AI a woman.
Right. It is possible that she never said those words at all. Yes, I used her as a source, but there are other people who say, basically, that the speech that we know is in a dialect that she would not have spoken. She was raised Dutch. But I think it's possible she had some kind of dialect, but it wasn't a Southern dialect that speech is written in. And a writer in Ohio documented a speech she gave and published it right after she spoke.
Dating age?
No. This is a male writer, I'm forgetting his name, but in an Ohio paper, gave a version of the speech, and I used that one. But Dana Gage gave two versions. The Ain't I a Woman that we know, and then there's a slightly different version of the same thing. And one of the tells in the speech is the most famous line, that birth 13 children or whatever it is. She never had that many children. She never said she did. And she might have had one sold off into slavery, probably not. But a lot of people take issue with the version that we know. And if you go on YouTube, you will see like 20 actresses and actors at least reciting the speech. I probably had to memorize it myself at some point. We've probably given it in my church. But when you hear it in the future, think about that.
Well, it was very inspirational.
It's different, right.
It's like an anthem.
Right. It feels true to people. That's what it is. So we like it. And we'll probably keep reciting that. But I wanted to explore that a little bit. And because, the other thing about the engagement, I don't think she was being dishonest. I think that she may have heard Sojourner Truth speak many, many times. And she wrote that speech from memory, taking snatches of something she heard or whatever, and trying to render it in a true way. But maybe she was familiar with Southern women and their dialects or whatever. But Sojourner Truth was not one. Just to answer your question, and maybe we'll wrap it up and I'll be quick. So I was not really, I'm embarrassed to tell you, I was not familiar with the concept of allyship. I'm just maybe a little out of that story. And the young man who did the trailer for my book, who's very involved in progressive movements, said, brought it up as a concept that was clear in the book. And so of course I did my research, I read up about what it means and what it means to be a good ally. You don't speak for others. You help where you're needed, you do what's asked, you don't take credit, all these prescriptions for a protocol of behavior. And I realized that in that 10 years, these men, just perhaps subconsciously, perhaps because it was so low on their agendas, these were power brokers. I mean, this was not the first thing they were worried about. Certainly in terms of social causes, most of them were much more involved with African-American rights, as white people than they were women's rights. It was secondary. Maybe that's why they never talked about it again, because 40 years later when they died, it just wasn't all that important. The vote had been won and the subject was closed. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons it was such a powerful issue, then it was so clean. You know, the vote is, this is a disenfranchised citizen. Let's fix that. It was fixable. It didn't have, you know, all the social and cultural overlay that so many other issues tend to have. So I'm excited about them as a model of what men today could do to help women by organizing and helping in ways that women are not always in a position to help. As an adjunct, I mean, at the very end of everything, and I'll just end with this, Laidlaw who made this incredible statement, when he gets thanked by Carrie Chapman Catt on the stage as New York wins, he says, you know, the women did it. The women did everything. And we men have learned something. We have learned to be auxiliaries. End of story.